Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 33 of NML Crossing, where we have hit the penultimate chapter of the Aftershock era. Got this one, got one more, and then we are officially on the road. That's might be one of them good news, bad news things, because the first three issues on the road are Asriel. And I don't want to spoil nothing, but woof. We'll worry about that another day. For now, we're going to talk about the first of two issues of Detective that are going to take us through the tail end of Aftershock. And we're starting with the regular-sized, not tarted up, 725th issue of Detective Comics. I guess milestones really weren't quite as big a thing at this point in the industry. But here we are, Detective Comics 725, at a September 1998 cover date. Story's called At the End of the Day, written by Chuck Dixon, with pencils by William Rosato. Inks Tom Palmer. Colors Gloria Vasquez and Android Images. Letters John Costanza. Edits Vincenzo Peterson. Cover price $1.99. And we open in flashback land, where Batman and Robin are battling the bowler. Now, this is a bowling-themed baddie who I can't track down whether or not he actually ever existed. He might just be for the, to cheese up this flashback scene here. I really don't know. I can't find anything on him. His gimmick, as you might imagine, has to do with bowling. And so our scene is littered with giant bowling pins, which the original dynamic duo gleefully biff and pow a bunch of flunkies into. Now, our narration is coming to us from Dick, who refers to this as being the good old days. Robin, it might be worth noting, is wearing his short pants during this scene, so this is from a time before DC was embarrassed by that. The recent World's Finest Teen Titans miniseries that just came out, it was like a Mark Waid thing, lined up with the Dawn of DC Titans coming out, and I guess Wade's own World's Finest stuff that he's doing over there. They changed it to where Dick Grayson always wore long tights. Now, that kind of annoys me. It's like, the short pants looked goofy and really, really weird. Like, they were goofy as hell. But seriously, own it. Don't be cowards. It's what he wore back then. It was like one of the things that kind of differentiated the Dick and Jason Robins from Tim, because Tim went right into the long tights when he was officially Robin. I don't know, stuff like that bugs me. I don't know why, but it does. Anyway, this takes us to the present, where Batman and Nightwing are standing on a ruined rooftop of a building overlooking a MASH unit. Now we've got a bunch of medical tents littering the scene. It's just a place for people to go when they're hurt, I guess. Now, Batman, he's not so sure the good old days were actually all that good. But Dick ain't buying it. Compared to the literal ruination of their city, dealing with the likes of the Joker and Two-Face back in the long ago was kind of a walk in the park. He then asks, so what now? Well, you see, Batman's been thinking about that. More like obsessing about that. He says that Gotham isn't really battling a war against crime at the moment. It's more a war for simple survival. Nearby, we see a lineup. There's a water tanker parked, doling out some of the drink at a rate of no more than 1 gallon per person. And I mean, these are tired and thirsty, and just these people are at their wits' end, so riots begin to break out. The people are literally fighting over drinkable water. Now, Batman gives a speech to Nightwing about civic duty and whatnot that feels a little bit precious. It's the whole, community as a contract sort of thing. Like something out of a Kennedy speech. Now, as the riot rolls on, the Bat 4x4 rolls up with, upon some of the wreckage, and then unleashes a torrent of green liquid into the crowd. Now, the green liquid is turpentine mixed with bat poop. It's a special blend Batman concocted in order to make the rioters think twice and also to shame them. And well, I mean, also, you're risking contaminating what little available drinking water as there is to the, you know, fine folks of Gotham City. Now, Batman actually appears to seem rather tickled by spraying the desperate crowd down with guano, which doesn't feel right. This is like the first smirk I've seen on his face since the quake, and he gets it from spraying poop on people? Well, the guys drive on and they chat. They keep talking here, and it's a bit more sit rep. We've had that over the past couple of episodes and issues. It's kind of like the Batman issue that came out the very same month. You know, it's becoming more and more clear to me that this is probably when the Bat Office realized where they're headed. And Batman talks about how power is still out in half the city. Clean water is clearly being rationed. Fires continue to rage out of control. There's well over 1 million people homeless. Thousands of people are leaving the city every single day. Blackgate escapees, they're still roaming the streets. And the GCPD is stretched beyond thin. Now Dick, ever the optimist, is like, yeah, we got this, you know? We're heroes. We can take care of this. To which Batman says, yeah, he kind of reminds Dick that he has his own city now. And he can't be constantly commuting back and forth between, you know, Bloodhaven, Bludhaven, and Gotham. Also, we get some more information here. Gotham's population has dropped by half over the past 2 decades, which, that seems weird, right? I mean, like, look at, I don't even know how many people are in New York City. Let's say, I don't know, 20 million people, just for ease of numbers here. Are we really to believe that in 2 decades, like, 10 million people would have left? You know, that's a lot of people. Gotham's already had the highest crime rate in the country. It just barely survived not one, but 2 plagues. And now, the very bad thing that happened at 7:03. Bruce then shares a meeting that he'd had with Lucius Fox earlier that day, which, you know, to really keep our spirits high. We get a refresher on the fact that all of the non-Wayne movers and shakers are, well, moving and shaking on out of Gotham. Which means a shrinking tax base, and even worse, unemployment. Now Lucius finally says what we've all been thinking for a while now. This crisis is too big a burden for Wayne Corp to shoulder on its own. Bruce, you know, keeping spirits high here, he then shares a meeting he had with Commissioner Gordon. Now, I'm going to assume this was a little bit after talking to Lucius. During this little conversation, Jim suggests that it probably would have been better had Gotham been completely totaled by the quake. At least that way, they could start over completely fresh. Because the way it is now, there's, like, just enough civilization left for gangs and organized crime to swoop in and start claiming territory. Batman then waxes nostalgic as he looks at the rubbly skyline of his once proud city. He speaks of how, after his parents were killed, he decided to sacrifice his own life for the betterment of Gotham City, thinking that he would transform it into something amazing, something that would far outlive him. But here he stands, looking at a dead city while he still lives, and powerless to do much of anything to save it. He then decides they ought to patrol Tri-Corner a bit. He hasn't been there in a minute or two. Now, as they make their way there, Dick pitches an idea that he had. You know, he's in Bloodhaven, Bludhaven now, and he's Bludhaven is a pit. It's, you know, it's even worse than Gotham in a lot of ways. So he is thinking about making a positive change to his city from the inside, and in so doing, becoming an actual police officer. Batman does not like the sound of this. He says it's too dangerous. He says it's blurring the line between his two personas, or personae, however you say that. I think that's Latin, right? Now, Dick takes a little bit of offense to this. And he says that Dick Grayson isn't a character he plays. Not like Bruce Wayne is to Batman. Now, upon arrival in Tri-Corner, we see the place is completely effed. I mean, it's been isolated since the quake, bridges were destroyed. I think we saw Sarah Essen here between her appearance in Azrael and her return to the GCPD HQ. So it's not in the best. It's like even worse than the rest of Gotham, pretty much. Batman tells Dick that he's been thinking about this whole persona thing. And he even suggests that in a situation like this, Bruce Wayne might actually be more of an asset to Gotham City than Batman. And Dick hopes this doesn't mean he's thinking about retiring the vigilante side of things. And of course he's not. But this does lead to an interesting chat about potential retirement for the both of them. Now, Dick talks about finally finding his place in the world and how at one point in his career he was a leader. And that nearly, you know, tore him apart. And, you know, they really wanted to distance Dick from his Titans roots, didn't they? Makes me wonder if they already knew that the Titans were about to make a comeback with Dick at the helm. Maybe they didn't know in the bad offices, who knows. Dick talks about how Batman tends to work with a partner. You know, like him, like Tim, and like the other guy. Now, Bruce says that Jason's not a bad word. You know, Dick can say his name. Though he does view Jason as a mistake. A mistake on his part for assuming that he could mold him into being just like Dick was in the short pants. And that sentence sounded far more risque than I thought it would. Dick then asks about Jean-Paul. And Bruce maintains that he chose him as a successor because of his drive. Thing of it is, he just didn't know that the drive in question was madness. Dick asks why Bruce didn't ever see him as being good enough. To which Batman says that that's not the case at all. In fact, he sees Dick as being even better than he is. Because, you know, Dick's been able to keep from losing himself in his mass persona, both of his mass personas. Whereas, you know, Bruce admits that he's lost himself to Batman. And it looks like we're headed straight to Hugtown here. Like they're approaching, they're kind of, the hands are kind of going out, but it's interrupted by the sound of gunfire. To which Dick is quite relieved, which is a little weird. We head to the ground where we see a group of Aryans calling themselves the White Wolves firing on a couple of officers who are trying to hold cover behind their car. And this takes us to our close, with Batman and Robin swooping down to dole out justice just like they used to do during the good old days. And that is where we leave it. Next time out is our final Aftershock issue. That has very, very little to do with Aftershock. It's Detective Comics number 726. Now, before we talk about our thoughts on this one, how about we hop into our letters here. Detective Comments. And this letters page is a little different. You know, usually the letters page is like the person's name and the city they come from or whatever internet service provider they use or whatever. This one's just like first names. It's like very, very casual in Detective Comments, so I guess we go with what we got, right? We're going to start with Jorge. Now, he hopes that the Huntress's bloodlust leads to a confrontation with Batman, wherein he puts her in her place. And he also congratulates Chuck Dixon on the Huntress spoiler one-shot. You know, it's funny, I very seldom, before starting this project, like, the character of the Huntress never went through my mind. Like, ever. It's like, I just never thought of her. And it's funny to see how she was on the forefront of so many people's minds back then. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. And I'm finding that I'm getting more of an appreciation for the character now that I'm actually, you know, sitting with her here. And I love that she's a character that is so contentious. You know, not in the Vesper Fairchild way, but in an actual, you know, costumed hero kind of way. She does have a different methodology than Batman, but, you know, she will play ball when it suits her, and other times she's gonna go her own way. I like that struggle between the two characters and the potential for conflict. I'm always a sucker for Bat family conflict, and I guess Helena is... She's bat adjacent enough for us to for me to consider her part of that family. Next up, we got Jeff, he suggests that Robin is far smarter than he is, since it seems that Robin already figured out the identity of the Quake Master. And well, Jeff, maybe we're in good company, because it took me until the actual reveal as well to figure this out. Robin was far smarter than I am. He's also unsure how he feels about the further vilifying of the Huntress. He thinks they might be pushing her a little too close to the edge lately. But at the same time, he also feels as though her behavior is, in some ways, justified. And he points out the Huntress spoiler one-shot, which he really, really dug as evidence of that. So another conflicted take on the portrayal of the Huntress. Pretty interesting stuff. Next up, we got Chuck. And Chuck, he's already figured out who the Quake Master really is, but he won't spoil it for the rest of us. He does point out that it's kind of telling that our big bad can't say the letter B, though. If only I figured that out. I had no idea. Next up, Matt. He would like more of the Huntress and Batman antagonism. He seems to really like it, but at the same time, is also growing tired of it. He just hopes it comes to a head sooner than later. He is really not a fan of the Huntress being on the JLA, but he says he will save those complaints for the other editorial team. So a lot of back and forth on Huntress here. We got our friend Heather, who I believe Heather has written into pretty much every single book so far. Heather loves Babs' portrayal all throughout Cataclysm, and yeah, I mean, she's written almost frustratingly good. As, you know, just taking command, being level-headed, being cool under pressure. And, you know, it always, I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but I feel like by returning her to the Batgirl persona, they actually took away from the strength and, like, vitality of her character and her utility. You know, she was like, pretty much the source for information for the entire Bat family, for the Justice League. I mean, she was one of the most important characters in the entire universe. But that wasn't good enough. We got to throw her back in tights and then put her in sillier tights to attract the young kids to read the books. I don't get it. Finally, we got Dennis, who sends not one, but two letters to tell us all that he, Dennis, is the Quake Master. So I guess we heard it here last. Now let's talk about the issue that we just read. I mean, this was largely a conversation. I mean, it was entirely a conversation. But I feel like it was a fun study of the Bruce and Dick relationship, especially with the post-Quake new normal as our background. And, you know, it's easy for me to see Dick's point of view, because it's a very human one, regardless of whether or not you dress up in tights or a cape. You know, the whole good old days thing, there's definitely something to that concept. Because, I mean, we're all human. We all have the mutant ability of hindsight, right? Wherein everything from the long ago automatically feels easier and far less complicated because we've already done it. You know, when you compare that to the pressures we face today, tomorrow, and into the future, everything that happened before, good or bad, it's still kind of tempered into the good old days because we got through it. You know, you figured it all out. And sure, in comics, it might be more fine a line, considering, for the most part, stakes used to be very, very low. Silly heroes punching silly villains, with everything cool by the end of the 20th page. You know, the scene that we got here featuring the very Silver Agey bowler character looked like it could have been something out of the 66 TV show. And something like that, juxtaposed with the almost post-apocalyptic current-day Gotham, was pretty striking. And I felt like it really drove home Dick's point. You know, we go from a silly, silly scene to looking at MASH units that are understaffed and overpopulated. No drinking water. You know, it's different. It's very different. Speaking of the drinking water situation here, I'm not sure how I feel about Batman hosing people down with bat poop. That seemed a little gratuitous to me. A little too cute by half for someone like Batman. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. That did not land for me. I thought that was not only in poor taste, but just, I don't know, that's just not what Batman would do, in my opinion. You know, like I said, I could be wrong. Now, Dick talking about joining the Bloodhaven, however we say that word, police force, I thought that was pretty cool. And I can't remember if this was a decision he'd already been struggling with in his own book, but we know for sure that this was definitely the first time Batman was hearing of it. And his reaction here was kind of surprising, but also not really. You know, it does feel like it could lean a little into the whole, flying too close to the sun. You know, it's like you have this gifted character like Dick Grayson, who's going to just absolutely outshine everybody on the police force with his ability and keen intellect. I don't know. I mean, there is definitely something about hiding in plain sight, but at the same time, I could see Batman's concern here, where it's like, you're going to join, you're going to be a standout immediately, and just so happens that we've got a hero who looks a lot like you. Anyway, I definitely like how Chuck Dixon is using his corner of the Bat Universe to move forward, like, all of his stories, though. It gives the books a sense of cohesion that, families of books, it could be kind of, I hate words like problematic, but it can be problematic when several creators share one character or a family of characters. The more voices you have, the more cooks in the kitchen, the more opportunity for contradictions and continuity lapses and just plain ignoring what everybody else is doing in their books. And so it was neat having Dixon kind of in having his finger in many pies here in the Bat Universe. He could just keep everything cohesive and push his stories throughout his entire little corner. I really like that. Back to the conversation. I'm always a sucker for Bat Family drama. When it's done well, you can't beat it. It's really, really cool. Like topics like Jason Todd and Jean-Paul coming up in conversation, that's never not gonna hit for me. I did find it a little bit odd, however, that Dick seemed to be the one getting uncomfortable during the chat, to the point where, like, he was relieved when he heard that nearby gunfire. That didn't really track for me. I think I'd have been down to see a quick bat hug before they got back to work, but again, what do I know? It felt like it was going that way, and it just struck me as odd that Dick was the one who was relieved that it didn't go that way. Overall, this was a really good story. I enjoyed it a lot. It probably should have been the story the Aftershock era of Detective went out on, honestly. Our next and final Aftershock issue is, well, I think even referring to it as a Red Sky issue would be a little bit too charitable. And I mean, not to spoil anything, it's a great issue. It's a wonderful story. I had a lot of fun with it. It just has zero to do with the current status quo. So this issue probably would have been the better one to go out on here. I think it ends on, like, tempered hope, like it's, Batman and the original Robin doing what they do. And I think that's as good a way to end an era as you're going to get, discounting, deaths and whatnot. But this was a good way to close us out. Now, before we get into the mailbag here, we do have a very, very, very brief dip into Wizard. Things are moving fast here. We're jumping around the calendar, so I'm trying to catch us up with all that's news, right? This is from Wizard 84, August 1988 cover date, and there's only one little bit, and it comes from the Buzzbin. And it says here, a new Bat Guy? As reported last month, 1999 will see massive changes in the Batman books as new and different creators jump on the Bat bandwagon. The only name we've dug up so far? Former Wolverine writer Larry Hama is on one of the books. Well, kinda. Well, we know with the benefit of hindsight that the books are going to go into, like, round robin, like almost Superman triangle numbering sort of mode here. So I'm guessing Hama's going to be on some of the stories, but he won't get assigned to one of the books until we're out of the No Man's Land era. I think he actually gets a gig on the flagship. I think he is the Batman writer coming out of No Man's Land. But for now, he's just one of many on the round robin of No Man's Land. And one more thing I wanted to touch on before we get into the mail here. I was looking through the Tomorrow's, what is it here, the American Comic Book Chronicle for the 90s, and I'm looking at 1999, and the main article here, the main feature of 1999 is No Man's Land. And we just covered Doug Mensch's last issue, last episode. and read here that he opted out of sticking around No Man's Land here. I guess he was offered to stay, but he did opt out, and he said, I didn't think it was a good story, and I didn't want to write it. I thought it was absurd that the U.S. government would deliberately cut Gotham off from the rest of the country. So I guess he wasn't let go. He just he took his ball and went home. That's really too bad. So I was enjoying Mensch's stories. I think he could have done some good stuff in the No Man's Land framework. But I guess that weren't to be. Alrighty, let's take this one home and hop into the NML bag here. We're going to start with a message from our friend Pat Sampson from the Longbox Crusade. And as you know, I've been talking about how we file our stuff. I get way too into the weeds and way too interested with our filing and boxing and storing of our comics here. And Pat says, my answers to your comic boxing questions today. I put the divider in front. I file 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. I put annuals at the end of the series, and I use tape for the bag and board. And I have boxes with numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And I use an app to track my comics location. And, that's pretty much exactly what I do, minus the tape. I don't use tape. I've long talked about not using tape on my bags and boards, but I just tuck. I'm a tucker. But I do use a numbering system, just like you do. My long boxes are numbered. They've changed recently because I was numbering them just like 1, 2, 3 up to, good grief, 100-ish long boxes. But even that got a little too unwieldy for me because my method of filing is stupid. If there's like an extra 6 inches of room at the end of box 4, it doesn't matter what books are in there. It's just like, okay, I'll stick the, you know, the Harley Quinn stack in there, even though it's with Rom, Space Knight, and Elementals. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter. There were no families of books when I started my my filing system because it was really just an exercise in where can I fit stuff. Recently, about a year ago, I took advantage of having an empty house to play in. You know, I put all my boxes in. I filled up like several rooms with boxes here, just one high, nothing stacked on anything else. So everything was wide open and I could finally put together something usable. So now I do use my numbering still, but I will also like letter beforehand. Like I have my X boxes. I'll have like X1, X2, X3, all the way up to, I'm looking at X number 18 right now. So I don't know if that's the highest X-Men box I got, but it's the one I see. Then I got like Bat 1, Bat 2, Bat 3, Bat 4, MC1 for just random Marvel stuff, MC2, DC1, DC2, IMG1 for Image. So that's how I do it. It's not perfect. It's definitely not perfect. But it's a little bit easier than the way I used to do things. It makes it, I don't know, it makes it so I can actually, I can find like the neighborhood of where a book's in rather than just like throw a dart and hope it's there. Like before I started this project, I had to dig for ages to get to my Robin books. And I had them in, I think it's like Bat 4, Bat 5 maybe. But I definitely use a similar system. I don't use an app or anything. I probably should look into getting back into the app game here because I hear that makes things easier. But that's never really been my bag. Someone asked me what it would say on my tombstone. It was about 6 months ago. We were just talking stupid stuff. And I said, what it would say on my tombstone is, he made this a lot harder than it needed to be. And that extends to everything in my life, including the way I file my comics. But thank you so much, Pat, for sharing your methodology. I definitely appreciate hearing from you. I always love hearing from you, Pat. Thank you so much. Next up, our friend Al Sedano. And this is our floppy talk here. You know, you guys know that that's one of my biggest pet peeves about the comics community, is people referring to single issues as floppies. Now, Al says he prefers to use the word pamphlet over floppy, but he's fine just referring to them as comics, though that is a very broad term. And I tell you, pamphlet probably wouldn't be my go-to, but it's definitely far more respectful than floppy. For me, I just call them comics. And yes, it is a broad term because, I mean, comics can be anything. Comics can be hardcovers. They could be omnibuses. They could be trades. They could be the strips in the newspaper. I mean, comics is comics. But I think pamphlet is worlds more respectful than the very dismissive floppy. But I thank you for joining in on that conversation and making me feel a little less insane for having such a strong stance on that little thing. Next up, we got our friend Eric here, who's writing in about the New York Magazine article we covered a few weeks ago. And he says, this was very informative, especially the part about Flushing, Queens, because my in-laws have me go with them multiple times a month. So hopefully, if a quake was to happen, I'm not there. However, that doesn't mean I'm any safer on the island itself. And I tell you, I'm glad you found the article interesting, because I was afraid nobody would. I thought this was going to be like, this is just, you know, tickling, you know, a Chris itch here. But I've actually received a lot of nice comments about the coverage of the magazine article, and I'm really glad I was able to track the thing down and share that with everybody here, because, you know, there are some stories we read or we've read where it's really, really obvious that they used bits and pieces of that article as inspiration for some of the stories they were telling. So that's really, really cool. And I also wasn't aware you were a fellow New Yorker. I guess I'm an expat now, but I was. But thank you so much for writing in. Next up, we got our friend Chris Yu, who's talking about Detective Number 722 and the New York Magazine article. Now, the issue, Detective 722, was the little girl lost story. And he says, this was a nice slice of life story. I can't help seeing a little similarity between the lost girl in the story and the post-crisis origin of Jason Todd. Both were abandoned by criminal or criminal-adjacent parents and found by the Bat family. She seems to have made it out better than Jason 2.0 did, though. And that's true. That is true. I didn't consider that. But there were definitely parallels that could be made there between, what was her name, Jayreen, I believe? Jayreen and Jason. Huh. I wonder if there is something there. Chris continues, I love those Tomorrow's Chronicles hardcover books. Hey, we just read a little bit out of that now. He says, I have the 90s edition. I got it as a gift, and I really want to get the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I can't recommend everything Tomorrow's publishes enough. I highly recommend their team-up companion softcover. And, Tomorrow's is great. Tomorrow, I kind of fell out with their magazines, like their current magazines that are coming out, like Back Issue and stuff. I thought those started off really, really strong, but now everything feels a little too fluffy. You know, it doesn't feel is academic the right word? I don't know. Just they don't feel the same anymore. I really don't know how else to put it. The early issues of Back Issue were wonderful. Alter Ego back in the day was great. I have dipped into some of the recent ones just if I find them, you know, for half price or something. I mean, they're $10 an issue. That's a lot of money for a magazine to me. But if I find them for half price or something, I'll grab a couple. And they're not the same anymore. I used to rely on them very heavily for Weird Comics History and The Cosmic Treadmill. We would cite Tomorrow's all the time. And I'm pretty sure that's part of the reason why I still pick them up when I see them, just in hopes that there'll be something there that I can use or transform or whatever. But I've been coming up kind of empty of late. But those Chronicles books, those are really, really good. I had those left to me by Reggie. It's the entire library going back to the 30s or 40s. And I haven't read all of them, but I have used them for research. For shows or posts or articles or whatever, and they always deliver. These Chronicles are really, really good, and I've got a handful of the companions as well, and those are great too. The first Tomorrow's book I got, and I didn't even know what Tomorrow's was when I got it, was the Komoda, the Miracle Man companion, and I swear that thing has fallen apart. How many times I've looked through that and read it, and I used it for our Miracle Man three-parter, Weird Comics History. just an amazing resource and just a world of information that I never knew I needed until I read it and realized I couldn't live without it. So yeah, those companions, if you can find those, nab them. Pick them up. Those are really, really good stuff. If you are a real-ass comics historian or a fake-ass comics historian like me, you'll definitely get something out of it. Chris wraps up with, I came for the comics and stayed for the earthquake knowledge. Very interesting stuff. And I thank you so much for saying that, because there must be thousands of hours of my voice recorded in various places. And I always think that I'm pushing a little too far with research. Like, I'm to the point where we almost hit like an uncanny valley. It's like, this is interesting, 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 interesting. Too far. No longer interesting. You're just up your own ass now. And I always worry about that kind of stuff. And as I was writing the script for the New York Magazine episode, it was like, oh boy, there's a lot of stuff here that might only be interesting to me. But so far, so good. People seem to have enjoyed it. And like I said, like the way we can like draw correlations between the article and some of the stories we've read, I think it was a hole in one. It was a good use of our time to check out that article and see what it inspired play out on the page. But thank you so much for writing in, and of course, invitations to everyone to write in. Anybody who'd like to join the conversation, I invite you to do so. You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, all the social media places. I ain't a hard fella to find. But I think that'll do us for today. Of course, I'd like to thank you all so much for choosing to spend some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight, starting